Welcome back, folks. Just as a reminder, in the 12 o'clock hour, we will visit with Guy Williams, President, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust, and we'll talk about the economic impact of the big, beautiful bill. At 11:30, we'll visit with Ryan Young, Senior Economist with the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and we'll talk about the jobs report. Showed an increase of 147,000 jobs. We'll find out what that number actually means and what were the expectations of economists. We're joined now by Dr. Jennifer Evagno, Director of the New Orleans Health Department. Dr. Evagno, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me back.
So let's talk about the big, beautiful bill. It has passed. A lot of folks are experiencing angst and anxiety over this bill. From what you're able to tell, how would it impact the city?
Well, it wouldn't just impact the city. It's going to impact the entire state of Louisiana pretty significantly when it comes to health care and food security. And that's because in Louisiana, more than a third of our residents overall rely on Medicaid. And in many parishes, not necessarily New Orleans or Jefferson, but a lot in the upper rural areas in the Northeast and Northwest, more than half of their residents rely on Medicaid. And what this bill does is makes it harder to get Medicaid and harder to stay on Medicaid, even if you qualify. And so we're really concerned there's going to be a tremendous ripple effect, not just for individuals who lose coverage, but for the rural hospitals and clinics that rely on those funding mechanisms to stay afloat, and just for the provision of health care in general.
How would it make it more difficult to be on Medicaid if you qualify for it?
Yeah, that's a great question. Two main things, right, which sound sort of good when you think about them, but they in reality are exceedingly difficult. So number one is increasing the amount of eligibility checks. So right now, every year, you have to recertify that you qualify for Medicaid. And you know, certainly that makes a whole lot of sense. It's not an easy system right now to re-up your eligibility. And so every year folks get churned off, not because they don't qualify, but because the paperwork and the bureaucracy make it really hard. And anybody that's had to deal with state or federal government knows how challenging bureaucracy can be, even if you have all the advantages like good working internet and, you know, a post office that works and that sort of thing. What we've seen when you go to every 6 months proving that is that just amplifies it. And so people get kicked off and then spend a month, 2 months trying to get back on and then have to recertify again. And if you think about a lot of our folks locally who are gig workers, seasonal workers, hospitality workers who might get paid more during, you know, high tourism times, maybe around the holidays, but then in the summer when it's slow, their income is different. And so it's different income levels. Having to do that every 6 months practically will kick a lot of people off. And a lot of times people don't know it until they show up in the emergency department and realize they don't have coverage anymore because they're in a diabetic crisis or, you know, something that is the result of being kicked off because of having to go through really clunky bureaucratic hurdles over and over and over again. We saw this in the Great Unwind after the pandemic when a lot of folks were kicked off and nationwide, and in some states up to 30-40% of people who were eligible lost coverage, and it takes a lot of time to get that back, and sometimes they never get it back. So that's one of the main ways. And it's really difficult.
So let me just play devil's advocate, though. I mean,
sure.
what is one to do when you're running a program and it's sensitive as to whether or not you qualify based on income or other circumstances that you find yourself in? I know in the state of Louisiana right now, they are running it twice a year now. And the reason I know is that we're caretakers for a family member, and we fill out the paperwork twice a year. They send us the Medicaid audit, and We look at it, we fill it out, we send it back in, and they have been doing this for 2 years now. And so that's not kind of unusual, but so what is government to do if you can't conduct an audit as to whether or not there are people that are on the rolls that shouldn't be on the rolls?
Well,
for example, in Obamacare, the most recent estimate is that 6.4 million people are enrolled in that program that don't meet the eligibility requirements. And if you're not checking, how do you move people off if they're not eligible?
I don't think we're saying not to check. I think that there are eligibility requirements for a number of social programs that are not integrated, right? If you are eligible for something like Medicaid, you should be automatically eligible for something like SNAP, because they're very similar, you know, requirements, if not the same. And so to make people do multiple different things at multiple times is confusing and effectively cuts people off. And especially if you're someone that is really living on the margins, and maybe you don't get mail reliably, maybe you're not at the same address for 6 months to a year because you have to change. You don't have reliable internet. Your phone service gets cut off. We're not talking about folks who have a lot of assistance and help and sort of time and wherewithal to do this. We're talking about folks who really don't. And again, we're not saying don't check eligibility, but what we've seen is that when you do it more frequently, you cut off people who really do deserve it, and you don't really do anything to folks who don't. And again, the biggest drivers of waste and fraud in Medicaid are not individuals who are, ooh, I'm going to sign up because I really want this, even though I make more money. It is sort of these big healthcare providers and groups, and there are not a lot of them, but they are able to fraudulently bill for billions of dollars. So that's where a lot of there's not a lot of fraud in Medicaid. It's really maybe not even 5% of the total, but where it's the biggest, it's not an individual. So punishing individuals, making them, you know, prove over and over and over and over again in different ways and just dropping them is going to make it hard. You know, and work requirements are the other big thing.
Why would we characterize that as a punishment? I mean, everything I sign up for, I have to prove certain things. You know, my professional responsibility as a lawyer, every year I've got to prove certain things. If I don't do it, there's a sanction. You have to do the same thing as a physician. As a public official, I served on some public boards in the aftermath of being sheriff. I got to prove certain things. If not, there's some punitive measures that apply if I don't do certain things, continuing education, this, that, or otherwise. At my own job, I got to do certain things. If I don't do it, there are sanctions.
That's right.
You know, Social Security, when I applied for Social Security, there's certain things that I had to do, or otherwise I wasn't going to reap the benefits of receiving the Social Security. There has to be, at some point in time, some personal responsibility and some accountability as it relates, you know, to all of these issues. And to talk about it as a punishment, I mean, you know, the folks that work in the federal government have a fiduciary obligation to the fund, to the entity. The entity's interest always outweighs the individual's. And, you know, punishment is just a little strong. I mean,
I don't disagree with you that, yes, of course, you want to make sure you have to do certain things, right? But it's a little bit different if you or I don't get our CLEs or our CMEs. That doesn't mean that we are going to lose a basic need to keep ourselves healthy.
I understand,
right?
But I just use it as examples of everything in life requires some accountability and proof of something, right?
I mean, so why does it have to be every 6 months rather than a year? I don't think anybody was clamoring, right, saying, please, it's because we're not checking eligibility every 6 months, and that's why we have all this waste, fraud, and abuse. That's just not how it goes. I think, you know, if we don't trust
if you work only 6 months out of the year and you earn above the eligibility requirement, why should we give you the money?
Because if you don't work the other 6 months out of the year, as many of our seasonal workers, whether that's farm workers, whether it's hospitality workers, then you won't have the benefit when you need it. And again, Medicaid is not just...
Well, but I think there that's is, the beauty of the two times check. You go in and you I'm not working now. It's the same with unemployment. You can't file for it until you're unemployed. I mean,
but to be kicked on and off of a benefit that... in pretty much every other developed country in the world is really seen as a right, to be kicked off every 6 months because you have a seasonal job means you practically do not have functional health care in a way that is going to maximally lead to health outcomes. And we're focusing on the individual, too, but I really want to focus on the rural hospitals that are dependent on Medicaid reimbursement. And the combination of more people being kicked off for whatever reason, the decrease in provider taxes, and other provisions in the bill means very practically that now not only, you know, even if people are, you know, kicked off, there's also not going to be places for them to go to receive care. And so, again, practically, that means their health outcomes are going to be worse. And we as a state are going to lose economic engines that really prop up a community. And again, not necessarily New Orleans or Jefferson, but we're talking about outside of Shreveport, in the Delta, in central Louisiana. And I think, you know, I'm not sure why we would want to do that, why we wouldn't want to make sure we have a thriving healthcare system with appropriate institutions that people can access, because that's when we see better.
I think they do. I think the threshold question is whose responsibility is it? Is it only the federal government?
No, it's not only the federal government, but
isn't that what they're saying here? Is that, hey, states, y'all have to be a little bit more in the game. You know, with Medicaid expansion, we've moved this from, in some states, almost a 100% reimbursement because of the way that we've handled provider taxes. You know, the reduction in the provider tax to 3.5% is interesting because that's what Obama proposed.
Mm-hmm. Well, but we don't have this argument about Medicare, right? And we fully believe that the federal government should fund that and at a much higher rate than Medicaid. And neither Louisiana nor any other state can fill that gap. And that's why you saw our state legislature, which is, you know, very one-sided in terms of party line, have a bipartisan resolution that, that really highlighted how important Medicaid was to the state. That's why you saw Governor Landry advocate for an increase in the Medicaid provider rates to 85% of Medicare, because they know how critical it is to our economic productivity, to our infrastructure, our healthcare infrastructure, and to our citizens. So, you know, we are looking forward to working with the state to try to fill these holes, but I don't believe there's a state in America that can make up for what the projections are for the losses.
No, but the same thing is, you know, as well as I mean, when we engaged in Medicaid expansion, a lot of it having to do to overcome with the trials and tribulations that we experienced in the pandemic, did you really believe that we were going to be able to sustain a 60% increase in Medicaid spending since 2019?
Well, no, I think the spending.
And
on
the only
what they've cut
is 1.5% in growth. Mm-hmm. So they're going to it's going to be 3 to 3.5% increase in Medicaid spending for the next 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So what they did is they just cut the growth, because what's happening is it's directly going to the debt. You know, that's why we're at $36 trillion. We can't continue this, you know, and the funding and financing of the rurals goes back a lot of years. In this state, and no one ever wanted to make the difficult decisions as to how that was going to happen. They took the UCC calculation of hospitals in New Orleans, Jefferson, and all the major metro areas, got that money and never paid back those hospitals. It's what caused East Jeff basically to go down, because they took all of that UCC calculation and gave it to the rurals. I mean, they robbed Peter to pay Paul. That was not a good proposition by any stretch of the imagination.
What it's done, though, is preserved rural hospitals where all the states around us have been closing them. And, you know, I think if you saw what happens when you close a rural hospital, that affects us in Orleans and Jefferson. That affects the urban areas because people come to us sicker and without care. And again, if we're just talking pure finances, let's remember that this bill adds $3 trillion to the deficit. So it doesn't achieve the goal of going to cut health care.
It's not a perfect bill by any stretch of the imagination. You know, we gave wealthy people a $40,000 tax deduction on salt.
Right.
That the Democrats wanted. I mean, why we did that, I have no idea. You know, so that they can go tax people more in blue states and get to write it off their income taxes. I mean, I certainly wasn't for that. But I mean, I just don't understand. You know, it's hard to get your head around this, Doc, when you see system expansion of infrastructure and stuff that's going on, and at the same time talking about, we can't take this cut in Medicaid. And one has to wonder whether or not, the C of N strategy, certificate of need strategy, needs to be revisited. Because what we realize now is that we cannot continue to fund the infrastructure cost of all of these hospitals in any of these states on the back of Medicaid. And that's what's happened. I mean, there's no denying it.
I think we all want a better system.
Would you agree or disagree?
No, I agree. I think that, you know, if we're talking about hospital financing, you also have to, you know, what is the role of, there's a lot of private equity now buying up small and low-income hospitals and then running them into the ground and closing them as well. So there's a lot to be reformed in terms of how we reimburse, how we finance hospitals. But slashing and burning, you know, I would love to have, like, thoughtful policy.
But that has to happen at the state level, not the federal level.
Sure.
Because,
largely has to happen at both the state and federal level. And I think our state really does think about these things very, very thoughtfully and carefully. And that's why, you know, I'm glad to be working with them on this. But if they've got the knees cut out from them, they're not going to be able to do a whole lot of innovative modeling if they are all of a sudden are missing a huge source of revenue to work with, right? Then it's just crisis management, right? Who goes down with the ship and what do we save?
I mean, everyone saw this coming. And, you know, I asked the president of the Senate the other day, do we have a plan? What is our plan? I mean, we know that we're going to have these Medicaid cuts. How are we going to absorb them? What is the plan? There is no plan. I said, well, we knew this is going to happen. I mean, we knew that. Even if it didn't happen this time, we knew that we could not continue to fund Medicaid at the rate of growth that existed out there. We all knew that. We would be lying if we said otherwise.
Well, I don't think it's just Medicaid, right? It's Medicare and Social Security as well.
But Medicare, it's a whole different relationship with states than Medicaid. And so is Social Security.
Right.
It doesn't have the nuances that Medicaid has from a relationship standpoint. And that's where the state obligation lies. And, you know, what we did was contrary to that, is that we got involved in exotic schemes to suck more federal dollars and relieve the state of any obligation. And if anyone thought that was going to continue forever, I don't know.
I think it's a little, it's definitely a complicated topic. And just when you think you understand it, it gets more complicated. But I think it just comes down to, you know, what are the benefits of providing health care? How do we do that in the most efficient, effective way, which ultimately is better for our economic prosperity and productivity? And so how do we do that with all of our social programs in a way that does not bust the budget and also doesn't add trillions to the debt, but also is you know, a little more consistent so that working families, whether they're rural, whether they're urban, at least know what they are, what they can rely on to make their decisions, right? Most people, not greater than 90% of people who are on Medicaid are working, caring for someone who's disabled or pregnant or a young child. And I don't think any of us think that by making it really difficult for them to access primary care, we've done a lot of work in that space, that's going to make us better or healthier as a community. So we can have thoughtful debates on how to do that. I don't think this bill did that. I think this bill, you know, sort of recycled some stereotypes, used that to put into place restrictions that are going to be very difficult for our state to meet. Again, I look forward to figuring out how we can preserve access and care as much as possible. But, you know, this is going to affect all of us in one way or the other.
We didn't do it when we gave the money either, when we engaged in these in these increases, when we expanded Medicaid and how these dollars were ultimately going to be spent, how they were going to be leveraged, whether or not it was going to go for infrastructure, whether or not it was going to go for more meaningful and intrusive day-to-day medical care for those that are impoverished. We didn't engage in any of those conversations at that point either. And, of course, no one was Monday morning quarterbacking them because it was like, just give me the money.
I mean, we did ultimately a little bit, but the
reality is that Medicaid expansion, and I don't mean this as a criticism because it is a very difficult issue, and to implement it, but that wasn't a smooth road by any stretch of the imagination. And, you know, there were a lot of dollars wasted, a lot of time wasted, not a lot of planning, and not unlike most federal programs, give me the money and I'll figure out everything later.
I want to say there's some really talented and smart people at the state who did work very hard on that. And what I do know is that it's resulted
of course there
in
is.
Hundreds of thousands of folks getting screenings that they never would have had, you know, getting care that they never would have had. It's kept our clinics afloat. It's kept our hospitals afloat. Is it perfect? Of course not. Name me one big program that is rolled out perfectly. Name me one private business that rolls out an initiative, perfectly. But on the net positive, I think if you asked folks, especially individuals, they would say it has made a positive difference. I work with LDH and Medicaid all the time. They're always trying to refine sort of what they do and how they do it and to make sense of a very, very big and complicated problem.
No, I don't disagree. I'm just saying, when we talk about Medicaid, the Medicaid reimbursement changes, twice a year in the amounts? That in and of itself is...
Yeah.
Is so disruptive to the healthcare system. We should think about that more than we should think about anything else, because by the time we've modified our software as to how we're going to bill, we're already changing it again. When you think about the opportunity loss and the money lost in the transition of those silly rules, I mean, it's absolutely incredible the amount of waste in this healthcare system. And I don't mean it as a criticism. I'm just pointing out these things that we need to change. And I don't know what is going to stimulate the change in culture and thought process about how we go about doing this. But what we know for sure is we can't afford it. The same way that we can't afford more poor people coming to this country, we don't do a good job of managing the poor now. You know that better than anyone. You've made it, a cornerstone of your career in looking out for that sector of the population. It's not happening. And so my question is, why would we want more? I mean, you know, because we can't we can't provide for the ones we have now. And it just doesn't, it seems counterintuitive to me that we would continue
friends,
to do that.
Our neighbors, our, you know, restaurant servers, I think we can do
it. I get it.
Right.
And I think those numbers are overstated. You know, we hear about the people picking, you know, in the fields. Only 29% of the folks in the agricultural economy are illegals. So that means 70% of people want to do it, you know, but we keep getting caught up in this rhetoric. But again, they're our neighbors, but they don't need to be our neighbors. We need to be smarter about who we're allowing in, because we can't ever correct this Medicaid problem if we continue going down this path that we're going, and what went on for 4 years under Biden. It's not going to happen. Math has no emotion. It is what it is. And, you know, we have to come to grips with that at some point, in my view. Dr. Evagno, thank you for all that you do. Dr. Jennifer Evagno, Director at New Orleans Health Department. Truly appreciate you joining us. Have a great week.
Thanks, Bill. Bye-bye.
Thank you. We'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Welcome back, folks. We are joined by Ryan Young, senior economist with the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and we'll be talking about the June jobs report. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So, Ryan, I guess there's, not unlike most jobs reports, kind of a mixed review of what this one reveals. Tell us about it.
Yeah, mixed is right. A lot of people were scared that the tariffs would destroy a lot of jobs, and it turns out the impact is pretty minimal. People are hoping for a lot of growth are also going to be disappointed, because when an economy is at 4.1% unemployment, that's basically full employment. There's not a lot of room to grow. So what we're finding is that the economy shrank last quarter, and a lot of businesses are in tough times, but it's not really affecting jobs too much. So, yeah, mixed picture.
And obviously, the Fed keeps a close eye on all of this and very much influences where they'll be with interest rates. What does this mean to them?
It makes it more likely they're going to hold rates steady at their next meeting. They meet every 6 weeks, in late July, if I have the date correct. Look for them to likely hold rates steady unless we get some very bad economic news. They're in a bit of a bind. They have a dual mandate, which contradicts itself, which makes their job especially difficult. One of their jobs is to contain inflation, and the other job is to stimulate the employment low. And the president has been pressuring the Fed to stimulate the economy to grow jobs. Of course, the trade-off to doing that contradicts the Fed's original QE mandate. So there, a lot of people have been saying the Fed's in a no-win situation. That's why. They have two jobs that contradict each other. Which are they going to choose? They don't know. So I would look for them to hold rates steady for the time being until things are a little more stable.
So let's pivot and talk a little bit more about this jobs report at a granular level, because some sectors of the economy are more advantageous when we see growth there as it relates to jobs and others, right?
Yeah. Yeah, the federal government has been losing jobs. That's mostly from DOGE. The impact has been pretty small. The total federal payroll is about 3 million people. And out of those 3 million people, that went down by about 7,000 jobs in June. So it's nothing earth-shattering, but it's down a little bit. Manufacturing is something that a lot of people are keeping an eye on, especially since 4 months in a row now, the manufacturing sector has been contracting. But the good news there is at least the jobs that are holding steady, they stayed almost exactly the same in the month of June. And a lot of that's because companies don't want to let people go. A lot of manufacturing takes pretty specialized talent, and the last thing a company wants to do is fire people if they don't have to. So they're going to eat some of the tariffs to the extent that they can. They're going to try to ride out hard times with savings. Maybe they'll hold off on buying new equipment But they're keeping their workers so far.
And the healthcare sector seemed to be a sector that almost every jobs report, quite frankly, they dominate. Is that still the case?
Yeah, I don't recall the exact number from last report, but it seems like every year the healthcare sector grows and grows, and a lot of it, it's not doctors, it's not nurses, it's admin. It's paperwork, it's people complying with regulations, it's, you know, people filling out paperwork. So jobs growth is nice, but ultimately what really matters is what those jobs produce. And a lot of those new healthcare jobs aren't producing better healthcare outcomes for people. So that's some waste that, frankly, I'm concerned about.
Is that a sector that it's going to be difficult to turn that around? I mean, we keep reading about shortages of doctors, shortages of nurses. There was a I read an article, I think it was in the Wall Street Journal the other day, or maybe it was the Washington Post. New hospital opens up. They can't staff it. The ER, for example, they can't open the ER because they can't staff the ER.
Yeah, there are a lot of reasons behind that. I think a big one actually is licensing. If you're licensed to practice medicine in Louisiana, you're not allowed, despite having all the qualifications, to practice medicine in Mississippi or in Texas. And that creates a huge problem. If there's a shortage of doctors in Louisiana and a surplus in Texas, we'll just move some doctors over. You know, some people can move from Beaumont over to New Orleans, no problem. No, you can't because of regulations. And there are other regulations that block construction, all kinds of regulatory requirements that get in the way. And how many doctors that could have been will never come to the U.S. in the first place now.
What happens with the professional education in that sector? I mean, has there been any significant improvement? Are we able to move more physicians out of medical schools and allied and others in allied health, knowing that we have these shortages? Have they've increased their enrollment and the graduation?
They're trying, but the American Medical Association actually likes that arrangement. They've made licensing requirements so strict and so onerous that, frankly, the word cartel might even apply to it. And they like it that way. When there's a shortage of doctors, those few who are doctors get paid more. It's very lucrative when you have a cartel-type arrangement, and the American Medical Association is doing its best to block a lot of those reforms to make it easier to practice medicine across state lines or to block telemedicine reforms or things like that that make it easier for people to access health care.
Well, how bad does it have to get before the AMA changes their attitude about this? I mean, it's pretty bad almost everywhere. I mean, I don't know of a single sector in the United States that has too many doctors or too many nurses.
Yeah, and frankly, I hope we never have to find out how bad it has to get before the AMA will change. I mean, one solution short of that, we're seeing a lot of clinics open up that don't necessarily require doctors. They might use nurse practitioners or people who have some expertise can provide basic level care, give people vaccines or checkups or anything else that they need. But as far as proper doctors, well, it's a shortage has a lot to do with regulation, and there are very powerful forces trying to block reform.
Ryan, we just had this, you know, I just had a conversation with a New Orleans Health Department doctor, Jennifer Avegno, and about Medicaid. I mean, so very much the attitude and the strategy of the AMA increases the cost of delivery relative to Medicaid.
Yeah, and that has its own set of problems. Oh, my goodness. But yeah, it's a broken
system. I understand, but I mean, this just doesn't make any sense to me. Are we just not connecting the dots, or is it just the power of the lobby?
It's part of that, but it's also part of the way it's structured. If you lose your job, you lose your health insurance. And for a lot of people, the only insurance they might have access to, it's the company plan or nothing. That's a legacy of a tax policy from World War II. It was essentially an accident that tied together health insurance to jobs. And when people don't pay that much attention to their health plan, or they don't pay much attention to how much they're paying at the doctor because insurance is paying and Medicaid are paying for 87% of healthcare costs, you know, people don't feel the impact. They don't And as a result, that's when healthcare is expensive. So it's not just that there's a shortage. It's that the price is also artificially expensive because, as far as the patient is concerned, if someone else is paying for 90% of the bill, that's like a 90% discount. And, you know, if you're paying, I'll have top sirloin, is how one economist put it.
Yeah, but if you have an organization like the AMA that's suppressing employment, I mean, somebody should be calling them out, right? I mean, it increases Medicare costs, Medicaid costs. This country's struggling right now. Pharmacy costs running amok. And here you have a major organization suppressing employment. I mean, it makes no sense to me. None. Zero.
Yeah, same. Well, I mean, at least you and I are calling on it at the start. We have most of the economics profession with us, but nobody listens to them.
Yeah, unbelievable. I mean, you learn something new every day. Just I can't figure that out. Ryan, as always, thank you so much for joining us. Totally enjoy the conversation and have a great week.
You too. Thank you.
That's Ryan Young, senior economist with the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Wow. We will be right back, folks. Stay with us. So just a point of clarification, the Congressional Budget Office added some explanatory details to the claim that 7.8 million more Americans won't have health insurance in 2034. That's at the end of the $1.3 trillion pareback on the spend in this big, beautiful bill over the next 10 years. Of that 7.8 million, some 4.8 million, they say, are uninsured because they won't comply with the bill's part-time work requirement. The bill asks able-bodied prime-age adults without children to work or volunteer roughly 20 hours a week. The American Enterprise Institute, who we just talked to, did a study on Medicaid recipients who do not report working. The most common activity after sleeping is watching television and playing video games. They spend 4.2 hours per day watching television and playing video games, or 125 hours during a 30-day month. Another 1.4 million of the uninsured, the Congressional Budget Office says, would be people who do not meet citizenship and immigration status requirements for Medicaid enrollment. The state can pay for it if they so choose, but the federal government chooses not to. The budget letter also says that the 7.8 million figure includes 1.6 million who have access to other forms of subsidized coverage, such as the Obamacare exchange, that they would actually qualify for. Now, the CBO says, even though the Republicans say that they're cutting, or they're turning back some, or paring back some of the spend, the CBO says that this bill actually will grow the expenditure by $200 billion over 10 years. That makes it about as clear as mud, right? We'll be right back.